next week, just to give you a bit of an advert for what's coming up, next week we begin a series that will turn back the clock to the time of Nehemiah, the second half of the 5th century BC, just over 400 years before the birth of Jesus. And Kevin will help us look at the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. But this week, we're in Bethlehem. For those who were here last week, there's a bit of a sense of deja vu, I think, because we're going to look at the events that surround the arrival of the Magi and their gifts at the house in Bethlehem. There was a moment last week where I was going to change what I was going to preach on when I listened to Susan's excellent account of the gifts and their significance. But, you know, maybe God has something special to say to us in having the same passage talking about the same things 2 weeks in a row. Maybe he's got some long learning in the same direction for us this week. So what are we to consider then this morning? What is Matthew in chapter 2 trying to say to us on this first day of 2023? On the face of it, the passage is about travels, communications, and the responses to the Messiah. But what exactly can we glean from the events narrated in this passage? First of all, I want to consider the people involved. They're all very familiar to us, as we've heard or read these stories probably many, many times. We have in my case, anyway. In chapter 2, Matthew introduces us to three groups of people. There are the wise men called the Magi. There's the highfalutin government in Jerusalem, Herod the Great and his advisors, the chief priests and teachers of the law. And then we have the humble holy family of Joseph, Mary, and Jesus. In order to understand the motivations of these people, perhaps it'd be useful to remind ourselves about these three groups. So the first group of people I want to consider are the Magi. It's not clear these days about exactly where they came from. Some think they came from Arabia. Some even think that they came from Ethiopia. And there are some that think that they came from the part of Iran called Parthia. And I think that's probably the more accepted view now, that they're Iranians, Persians. And they were probably followers of the religion of Zoroastrianism. They were clearly astronomers because they were looking at the sky and they saw changes in the sky because they noticed when there was a new star. And maybe they were astrologers. They seem to think that this new star heralded the birth of the King of the Jews. And they clearly thought that the star was worth following. Now, I don't know if you know how far it is from Parthia on the eastern edge of Iran to Jerusalem. Google Maps told me that it's roughly 1,700 miles. Now, even today, that's a fair journey. It would require a significant undertaking with four-wheel drive vehicles, and it would take several days. Today. But 2,000 years ago, when you were relying on horses and camels, wow, that's a big job. Because you're out there for couple of weeks, maybe, or maybe even a month. So along with the wise men, well, we see three people, don't we, when we talk about the wise men, or in my mind we did, until I started thinking about it. Alongside the three wise men, there's probably an entourage of soldiers to keep them from being robbed. They had valuable gifts with them. They'd have servants with them to make and break their camps, and a significant amount of baggage, because they'd have to house all those people overnight, each night for a month. So they need forage for the animals, and they need food for themselves. Because as I understand it, a lot of that, oops, my dad used to do that. Only in his case, it was some candles and things. In the journey across that Iran, Iraq, Jordan to Jerusalem is mainly desert. So they're on their own. 24 or so days. So in my mind, I'm thinking that's a significant response to seeing a star. I don't know, look, if you've looked in the night sky recently. There was a significant event the other day when you could see all the planets. I'm not sure we could from here, but you could see all the planets just after sunset. They were all there. You could see them all with the naked eye, bar two. The two furthest away from us, you needed binoculars. Well, wouldn't that have been great to see if I'd known about it before the event? Matthew's telling us here about the, in some senses, about the wealth and the significance of the decision that the Magi made to make that journey to visit Jesus. And it also tells us something about what they considered to be the significance of Jesus. They recognized him, born King of the Jews. Let's put the Magi aside for a minute. And let's consider this highfalutin government that's in Jerusalem. These are not people that listen to God. History books tell us that they're not considerate, they're not empathetic. They're people who enjoy the trappings of power. Herod the Great and the chief priests and teachers of the law are not compassionate. Not only do they not show empathy for those who are less fortunate, but they show bias, and they spend their time planning the feathering of their own nests. Herod the Great was brought to power in Israel through a mixture of family ties and the wealthy backing of the Roman hierarchy. He was a brutal ruler. He had a history of large building projects, which he forced the people of Israel to build and to pay for. He built extensions to the temple grounds. He built a fortress at Masada, and he built a palace for himself outside Jerusalem called Herodium. We can infer from what Matthew says in chapter 2 that he was a man of short temper. And so when Matthew says in verse 3 he was disturbed and all Jerusalem with him, it can be inferred that his reputation for violent acts to appease his displeasure was commonplace throughout his reign. But he was a client king. He wasn't there in his own right or elected by the people. The Romans put him in place, and he exploited that. Herod was an Edomite. He was a descendant of Isaac. And whilst he may have converted to Judaism, he lived a hedonistic lifestyle. He needed the chief priests and teachers of the law to advise on what the scriptures foretold. And we can also infer from what Matthew says that he was a devious man, because he talked to the Magi secretly and got them to, or asked them to come back to tell him where Jesus was living. Our third group of people are the Holy Family, people of humble origins who listen to and obey the messages they receive from God. All we've heard about Mary and Joseph is that they've been visited by angels. They've listened to dreams. They've received the messages and obeyed them. And we hear again through this passage that Joseph is spoken. He's spoken to in a dream. And they flee to Egypt until after Herod has died. All in fulfillment of prophecies. The birth of Jesus in Bethlehem fulfilled the prophecy in Micah. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. And the exile in Egypt fulfilled a prophecy in Hosea. In Hosea chapter 11, out of Egypt I called my son. Matthew's keen for his readers to know the background. And so he leads us on from the genealogy of Jesus in chapter 1 to the fulfillment of the prophecies in chapter 2. He wants us to have confidence that Jesus is the anointed one of Israel. It's significant, isn't it, that in verse 2 of chapter 2, the Magi tell Herod that they come seeking the baby who is born King of the Jews. In that phrase there, he's born King of the Jews. He's not a baby born to be King of the Jews, but he's a baby born King of the Jews. He's not a baby who is born to grow into the role of the Anointed One, but Jesus is born the Anointed One of Israel. Jesus is born the Messiah. He's not appointed by any human force. He was born King of the Jews. So I wonder whether we should move on now to consider the responses of the people to these events in Bethlehem. I guess we can only wonder at what the response of the Magi was on meeting the baby Jesus. We can only wonder about their discussions as they made their way home again via a different route to avoid speaking to Herod. What Matthew tells us is that they did bring their gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and they did bow down and worship Jesus. They were the first Gentiles to acknowledge Jesus, the Son of God, born King of the Jews. Herod's response is more clearly documented by Matthew. And what a response it is, clearly consistent with his personality and with his brutal record. On recognizing that the Magi were not going to tell him where the baby was, his response was one of overwhelming force, bringing overwhelming sorrow to the town of Bethlehem by killing all the boys under the age of 2. The Holy Family's response to the events that surrounded them was essentially about self-preservation. They listened to God, and their obedience response was to take off for Egypt, to become refugees and asylum seekers. but perhaps I've overlooked a group of people. Matthew, like all writers, is writing his gospel for the benefit of his readers. This morning, for the benefit of us. So what about us? How are we to respond to the words we've heard and seen in chapter 2? Last week, Susan referred us to the response of the Magi to worship the newborn king as she introduced the final song of the service. And as I prepared this week and I considered our response to the words Matthew wrote, recording the visit of the Magi, and our response to the baby born King of the Jews, I was reminded of the words Christina Rossetti wrote in that well-known carol. In the bleak midwinter, frosty wind made moan, earth stood hard as iron, water like a stone. Snow had fallen, snow on snow, snow on snow, in the bleak midwinter, long ago. Our God, heaven cannot hold him, nor earth sustain. Heaven and earth shall flee away when he comes to reign. In the bleak midwinter, a stable place sufficed. The Lord God Almighty, Jesus Christ. Angels and archangels may have gathered there. Cherubim and seraphim thronged the air. But his mother only, in her maiden bliss, worshipped the beloved with a kiss. What can I give him, poor as I am? If I were a shepherd, I would bring a lamb. If I were a wise man, I would do my part. Yet what I can, I give him. Give my heart. Whilst Christina sets her poem in the depths of a cold, hard winter, probably the cold, hard winter of 1871, she draws the reader to give a personal response to the Christ child. The first few stanzas set the scene, but the last stanza talks of a response, of a personal response to the Christ child. Talks of the response of the visitors to the Christ child so long ago. And there's a sense in that final stanza of the response of the writer Christina Rossetti herself. But perhaps when she was writing the words, she was also considering that the words she was writing would be the response of her readers, who would say the words for themselves, as I have this morning, when they spoke the words out loud as they read the poem. So today, as we gather here and look forward into 2023, perhaps we should consider our response. As we look forward into 2023, can we gather our thoughts and consider afresh an acknowledgement of Jesus as first in our heart? Can we consider our own gifts as being given in worship to the Christ child, to the baby born King of the Jews? Can we consider our response to Jesus to be, Jesus, what can I give you, poor as I am? If I were a shepherd, I would bring a lamb. If I were a wise man, I would do my part. Yet what I can, I give you. Jesus, I give you my heart. Amen.